Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome, welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Western Idaho. Our AccuWindow forecast, about 70 degrees and very, very windy. Should be clear skies tonight. The solar wind tonight, 351.8 kilometers per second. And the proton count is way down to 1.9. The phones started ringing around 7:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on Saturday night, September 19th. All along the U.S. Atlantic seaboard, police stations and news desks received reports of strange lights in the sky. It looks like a passing comet or a giant luminous amoeba. But this was pure rocket science. The cloud was created by a Black Brant 12 sounding rocket launched from NASA's Wallops Flight Facility in Virginia. The rocket released a cloud of electrically charged aerosols near the top of Earth's atmosphere to investigate the formation of noctilucent clouds, or NLCs. Mysterious NLCs form naturally around Earth's poles during the months of northern summer. On this September evening, researchers decided to see if they could create an artificial NLC. Interestingly enough, it seems to have worked. Ground-based cameras and radars along the Atlantic coast monitored the experiment while the STPS-AT-1 satellite watched from Earth orbit. Principal investigators at the Naval Research Lab hope the data will reveal much about the microphysics of noctilucent clouds and the possible role of rockets in creating them. So, does this mean that when we see NLCs, there has been a recent ship enter or leave our domain? Interesting indeed. A tempest that erupted on Saturn in January has become the solar system's longest continuously observed lightning storm, astronomers reported on Tuesday. The storm broke out in Storm Alley, a region 35 degrees south of the ringed giant's equator. Researchers told the European Planetary Science Congress in Potsdam near Berlin, thunderstorms there can be as big as 3,000 kilometers, nearly 2,000 miles across. The powerful event was spotted by the U.S. space probe Cassini using an instrument that can detect radio waves emitted by lightning discharge. Very interesting. Glad we don't have lightning storms that last that long here on Earth. There were 23 earthquakes greater than 2.5 and only 3 greater than 5.0 in the last 24 hours. All is quiet on planet Earth. Tonight in Phoenix, Arizona, KFNX 1100, we are preempted by the National Football League. We are honored to be bumped by the NFL because we are football fans. We welcome thousands of Phoenix listeners to the web tonight to listen to X Squared Radio via the BBS Radio Network. We've been on BBS Radio now 4 years, going on 5 years, and we're at home here, and we're at home with our audience all around the world, and we appreciate you. By way of news, global green cars made history again this weekend by pacing the Mustang Series race at the very prestigious Miller Motor Park in Tooele, Utah. Speed Channel watchers got a chance to see the first electric vehicle pace a nationally ranked race. The truck, the EV truck, did just fine, and the fans loved it without burning a single drop of fuel. If you want to know more, go to globalgreencars.com. If you're in the market for an EV or ever thought about having an EV and you want to know, gee, will they drive the way I drive? Can they do what I do on the road? Watch it going around the racetrack and decide for yourself. Last week on X Squared Radio, we had an archive of Dr. Bruce Lipton, the author of The Biology of Belief. I got good reports. It's a great program. If you missed it, go back and listen to the archives. The subscription is very inexpensive, about the price of one cup of coffee per month. And you'll have access to about 200 hours of archives with the world's best authorities in many great subjects. This week, we have the author of Deep Analysis, Frightening Conclusions. Our Watchers, Our Keepers, From Days of Old Till the End of Time. Tonight, you are going to find out how World War II, the Hollow Earth, and the Nephilim all tie together. My guest tonight is Aaron Kaplan. Welcome to the program, Aaron.
Thank you for having me on.
Oh, it's our pleasure. I have to tell you, this is one of the rare books that takes you by storm. I couldn't put it down. And I want to save the Roswell crash stuff until the final hour. So let's start at the beginning. How far back do we need to go to understand the deep analysis of the Earth and its current inhabitants, the humans?
We have to go as far back past the Bible days. But unfortunately, we don't have much information past that. Ironically, the crash of Roswell is a direct tie, to the days of the fallen angels, as we all know, and the creation of the earth, to Genesis. A straight line connection of the dots, direct. I know it's hard to believe, but took a lot of research, but I believe my investigation of it makes a straight line connection.
So are we talking about, what, 450,000 years ago?
Well, according to some experts, including the great Zechariah Sitkin, he claims that the planet Nibiru, or the Anunnaki, first made contact with our planet, the Earth, approximately 450,000 years ago, and they came to mine here gold, and that gold was used, I understand, to form canopies around their planet Nibiru for protection over the cities from the weather. That was the first contact that the dead races had with this planet. Now, my research goes a little further. By reading very carefully a few books, now, let me make something very clear. I'm going to refer to one book called The Bible. However, I have to be careful. I'm not a religious person. I strictly use that book for scientific purposes for information. Strictly. So when I mention names, I hope that the world can understand that I'm using it as a history book for reference and scientific purposes only. It's very important. It's a very accurate book, and it contains a lot of information if you use it properly. So I hope that I've used it the right way. Now, if you remember, in the book of Genesis, we hear that the earth was created, and first the form, the land, the firmament, the trees, the animal, the fish, and then mankind came last, etc., etc., etc. These are direct steps that any scientist in a laboratory will agree these are the exact steps to terraforming of the planet. Exactly.
Interesting. So these Anunnaki, are they the Nephilim we read about in the Old Testament?
Yes and no. There are two types of Anunnakis. There are two types. The Nephilim came, they are the Anunnakis. However, the word Nephilim in Hebrew means the one who fell down to earth. They are the Anunnaki. But originally, the Nephilim only consisted of approximately number roughly 200. From Sumerian tablets that have been found and other sources, including the Book of Enoch, which is pretty accurate. Now, the Anunnaki, who came from the planet Nibiru, they formed this planet. Not only our planet, but I believe that they formed our whole galaxy. Originally including Mars and other planets, originally. They are in charge of our galaxy. We hear stories of many alien races come and go, through abductions, human abduction by aliens. I do not believe that's the case. I believe the original Anunnaki, they own this galaxy. Other races do come and go like tourists. They come here, they take pictures, they observe it and leave. I don't believe that any other race is allowed to stay here on our planet and perform any experiments. Those Anunnaki, I believe, are very, very strong warrior race. They're very fierce. I believe the whole universe knows that they formed this galaxy and it belongs to them. Now back to the Nephilim. Those 200 Anunnakis who supposedly fell to earth, they may have done something wrong, either by not observing their own rules, or try to pull a few stunts that backfired at them. But apparently, the whole race of the Anunnaki was after them and tried to punish them. And roughly about 55,000 years ago, they imprisoned those 200 Nephilim to this planet. They are known as the Banished Ones. So supposedly, the whole universe knows about those 200 Nephilim, and they are known as the 200 Banished Ones. They are imprisoned on our planet. They cannot leave for various reasons.
Sounds interesting and challenging. A very proud, fierce warrior race picked out and banished to a planet like Earth. And when they were banished here 55,000 years ago, I don't suppose there was modern humans here. They probably had some advanced animals here, but were these a group of advanced extraterrestrial geneticists?
No, actually, 55,000 years ago, there were humans here. That's the problem. There were humans here. That's the problem. That's the problem. There were beautiful women here. That's the problem.
Interesting. Now, some people say that these were the giants mentioned in the Bible. Where did the giants really come from?
Okay. The giants came from intermarriages through relations between the Anunnaki and the women of Earth.
Aha.
So apparently, the women of Earth and mankind were created much older than 55,000 years ago. How much older or earlier, I couldn't tell you exactly. I couldn't even guess. But they were created earlier. Because the story, legends, and Genesis and the Sumerian tablets clearly states that when the Nephilim fell down to earth, those 200 who were pursued by the Anunnaki for what they've done wrong, when they fell down to earth, there were already giants existing here on this planet. That means those giants usually came from birth, from sexual relations between the Anunnaki and the beautiful women of Earth. their offsprings grew up to be giants.
So do you think the presence of these giants had something to do with these 200 being banished to Earth?
One reason. The other reason very possibly could have been, if you read in Genesis, in the fourth or fifth year of creation, the Old Testament and the New Testament. The New Testament claims that God created great creatures. The word that's being used in the New Testament is great creatures. However, the Old Testament uses a different word. In Hebrew, it's called taninim gdolim. Taninim means alligators or crocodiles. That's exactly what it means. And gdolim means big or giants. So apparently, those 200 Nephilim, while they were creating life in the universe, especially on Earth, for some reason or another, they chose to create giant alligators, which we know of course, another word, dinosaurs, etc., etc.
Interesting. So now, humans and dinosaurs existed at the same time on the Earth.
That's correct. And apparently God, either capital G or little g, whichever way you want to use it, God's those days were known as Enlil or Enki. They were in charge of the Anunnakis. Those were the gods of days of old. Other religions use the name God for whatever purpose, that's fine. Now, those gods got very angry that those Nephilim did create those large animals to live next to man. Because apparently those two cannot coincide. There's no match.
Rule violation.
That's correct. That's correct.
Now, this knowledge, primarily, it comes from the writings of Zachariah Sitchin. Are his writings accepted by everyone? I mean, does he have enemies because of what he has written?
Until a few years ago, he was accepted by everybody. His information is pretty good. As a matter of fact, during the Iraq War, the U.S. government, the U.S. Army, even hired him to use his knowledge to create playing cards for our soldiers in Iraq. And the playing rack consisted of, the playing cards consisted of historical artifacts. What I'm trying to say, I don't mean to get on the subject, that our venture in Iraq may not have been 100% military action toward a specific group of people. It could have been an excuse to dig in and look for certain artifacts or similar reasons. Now, a few years ago, Zachariah Sitkin wrote a lot about the year 2012. Specifically mentioned the date of December 21st, 2012. But lately, if you listen to his speeches or his writings, he's tending to go to left field. He's letting go of the dates. He's starting to give later and later dates. I believe something is going on right now between Zachariah Sitkin and the U.S. government.
Oh, really? So you think governments are trying to keep him quiet?
Yeah, apparently something is going on. A few years ago, it started 5-6 years ago. I don't have the facts. I only did research on the internet and newspapers articles that I found. They tried to bring him up on some ridiculous charges. I mean, the guy's, what, 87 years old, 85 years old already? And the exact charges, I'm not sure. I don't believe that's correct. But what they've done 2 years ago by court order, Now listen to this. If I'm correct, it's a real big find. They almost forced him to surrender all data that he has on regarding to the planet Nibiru, the 12 planets, and the date, December 21st, 2012.
Now, is it only governments, or do you think churches are involved in keeping him quiet as well? Because, you know, what he says, what he has translated, apparently, from the Sumerian texts, seems to conflict with the interpretation of certain religious groups and church governments. Do you think churches are opposing him as well?
It's not a church. We look at the church and the leading organization of the church is the Vatican, the center of the Christian Catholic religion, and the Pope. But it seems to be that the Vatican itself is a very strong stronghold, or was actually was created by the Nephilim originally as a center to gather information and keep the world population at bay.
Interesting. So do you think it's possible that the religious writings that we have, not the least of which is the Bible, do you think that those are or could have been crafted by, shall we say, stories or even misinformation generated by the Nephilim? If they created these religions and these major church governments and let out this information, like the terraforming you described in Genesis, do you think that they're involved in a subtle or massive disinformation program?
Yes. You have to realize, when the Bible first came out, was written by King James on the 1500s. Even as late as 1500 AD, mankind was not very, very smart. I mean, we didn't have radio, you know, like the radio shows like yours, TV, cable TV, internet, telephones. We had a horse and buggy, and so Indian drums, and smoke signals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Nephilim then, we're not worried about a story in the Bible because we couldn't do anything about it. We believed it as a religion. We prayed. We followed certain rules. But now we're getting to a point where we're becoming so knowledgeable to the Nephilim now beginning to fear our knowledge. We're now going too fast forward.
Well, we exist in large numbers, too. I mean, we there's almost 7 billion of us on the earth, and we're rather unpredictable, and we're kind of heady and egotistical as well.
Well, the number doesn't threaten them. What they're afraid of, they have an agenda, according to my interpretation.
Ah, see, I was going to ask you, what are they doing? I mean, what is their purpose for going around the universe introducing new life forms? What are the Anunnaki, what are these banished ones up to?
The banished ones cannot create life anymore because they are banished to this planet. So the original 200 are on Earth. The rest of the Anunnaki are still going to the universe, I believe. Built terraforming planets. Now remember, they live on a planet Nibiru that supposedly is supposed to come around every 3,600 years. Supposedly. But those Nephilim are trapped on this planet. They are also the Anunnaki, but they are the fallen ones who were banished here by the superiors. They cannot escape the Earth. And we'll explain later on why. So those 200 Nephilim, they are trapped here. But I believe that they know something about a date, 2012, something will happen. They themselves are very fearful. They are trying their best, any way they can, to escape at that date. so far, they're unable to. They're not able to. But they're trying to escape.
Interesting. So we will talk about that later on in the last hour. What it is that's keeping them here? If they're so advanced, why can't they leave? So, Earth explorers, please do not leave early. In fact, what we want you to do is pick up the phone, call your friends, tell them to tune in, because what is in this book? And we're talking about Aaron Kaplan's book. It is called Deep Analysis, Frightening Conclusion. You have probably never heard this before. I know I haven't. And, you know, we've been investigating subjects like this now for over 4 years on this program. So if you really want to know why it is that the Nephilim are here, why the Banished Ones are here, why they can't get off this planet, stay tuned for the third hour. Now, what we want to do now is we want to open up all the phone lines. So if you want to call in to X Squared Radio, you can do that toll-free worldwide, 888-228-4494. If you don't have access to toll-free numbers in your country, no problem. You can dial 530-776-5154, 530-776-5154. Call in and get involved in this program, because we are about to go well beyond your imagination. Now, Aaron, there are 200 of them here. Do they have a boss? Do they have a leader? What's their leader's name?
Originally, there were 200. But I believe that through a process that we call cloning and interbreeding, by now, I'm not going to say where the location is yet, but by now there may be as many as 2 million of them. Now, the original 200, some of the original one may still be around. Some will have gone into deep freeze, I believe it's called hydrogenics, and are still around. A few of them may have come out of deep freeze some years ago, and I explain what I mean a little bit later on. And something happened down south, certain operation. But right now, there may be as many as 2 million of them, but they're hidden in a certain area. And the U.S. government is trying the darndest to keep it a secret, worse than the original Manhattan Project. It's a big, terrible secret. And if that secret ever comes out, that automatically would tie in Roswell, and if you play chess, it's called checkmate time.
Wow. That's really earth-shaking stuff. You're tying together three of the most infamous, most giant government cover-ups of all time into one story, and this is really, really big.
That's correct. And the certain operations that were famous in the 50s or late 40s were heard of, but slowly, slowly those operations have been hushed up so quietly. Many admirals, many generals, many heads of government have suddenly, supposedly, committed suicide by strange ways as soon as they opened the mouth about one or two military operations that happened in the late 40s, just before Roswell. That's very important. Before Roswell. The government is so clever and disinformation that if you read certain internet sites, they actually claim that this operation took place after Roswell. They're very clever, including modifying a certain diary that was written by a great admiral. And his name is Admiral Byrd. He's very sneaky. He's very tricky.
You know, we fell into a copy, a supposed copy of Admiral Byrd's diary, and I read it. I read it a couple of times, but I've also read some actual writings from Admiral Byrd, and I've read several official accounts of his explorations around the planet. And the guy really is an aviation hero. He really was a brilliant, brilliant admiral. I got to tell you, I have my doubts that the diary of Admiral Byrd is authentic.
I'm with you, and I know exactly why. I solved the enigma of his diary. It's very sneaky, very tricky. Are you ready for this?
We're ready. Let's get started.
Okay. Admiral Byrd wrote a diary in two parts. The first part was handwritten by him until he landed, supposedly, in the inner Earth and was accepted for dinner or for lunch by a certain alien race. After he left that area and returned back to his base, he didn't write a diary anymore freehand. The rest of the diary is written or typed way afterwards, after he landed. Now, the reason why the diary is tricky, I'll explain to you exactly what's going on. Exactly. Just follow me. So let me know what it sounds like.
Okay.
If you ever watch football games or basketball or baseball, or even horse racing, like off-track betting, whatever, there are always organizations who try to bet on a game to win the game, to win on the winning side. In order for them to make sure that their side wins, when I mean their side, I'm referring to the wallet.
Ah, right, because they're betting on the game, right.
That's right. Now, remember, today to win a game, you don't have to blackmail all the players. You only have to reach one major player in the team. If you can get to him, any way, shape, or form, you can almost assure a win or a loss, whichever way you bet. Now, take a diary of Admiral Byrd. Now, we know for a fact, from military records, that Admiral Byrd, February 16th, on January 29th, on Operation High Jump, he was the first pilot to take off from the carrier Philippine Sea, an R-4D aircraft, which is basically a converted DC-3. There were six of them, fully equipped for spy missions. When I say spy missions, I'll use another word, for scientific exploration with super, super cameras, very secret cameras, called Prometricon. However, those cameras do not operate at nighttime. They need bright daylight to work.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Now just keep it in mind. At that time in Antarctica, was summertime. It was daylight between January, the end of January, to mid-February. Admiral Byrd took off from the carrier in front of hundreds of witnesses on the 29th of January, toward a base called Little America 4 in Antarctica, in the South Pole. I repeat, Antarctica, the South Pole. That's where he was. Now, if you read his diary, something happened here. Suddenly he's in the North Pole. What is Admiral Byrd doing in the North Pole? Strange. Those R4Ds with dramatic cameras cannot take pictures in the dark. Because that time in North Pole, it's called the celestial winter. It's pitch black. The U.S. government screwed up. They didn't take it into account.
That's true. If it was the 16th of February,
right,
it would have been during the time of eternal night, 6 months of night time in the North Pole. So they had to be in the South Pole.
Bingo. What they did, something very simple. If you read Admiral Byrd's diary, remember, that diary was first introduced on the Art Bell show. Supposedly by one of his grandsons or his cousins or whatever, in 1995. And a few months afterwards, everybody claimed, oh, I'm sorry, his grandmother came, they didn't know, we didn't know, it's wrong, but somebody got to them. But I believe the whole mishmash, I call it order out of chaos. It was done purposely to confuse the issue. It's a very famous saying by George Bush when he was in Iraq. It's order out of chaos. That's exactly what happened to the diary. What they did is very simple. If you read the diary, they changed two or three words in the whole diary. From South Pole, from South to North, and from Antarctic to Arctic. That's all the government did. Changed two words. Nobody will ever realize what's going on.
So all of the attention shifts away from a key area on the planet, Antarctica, the South Pole.
That's correct. It was done so cleverly, like you wouldn't believe. And they did one more thing. That's going to sound really, you know, not out of this world, but it's going to sound funny. Are you familiar with the name Amadeo F. Giannini?
Giannini, yes.
Okay. His family not only owns the Bank of Italy, they also own the Bank of America. How about that?
That's correct.
The bank that only very, very lately was mysteriously bailed out by the U.S. government. Hey, how about that? I'm not making this up. That's a fact.
Yeah, they got upside down with a lot of bad loans, had to be bailed out, and a lot of people don't know where that money came from.
Right, very mysteriously. And nobody's bothering Bank of America. Now, that family, Mr. Amadeo Giannini, wrote a book, I believe, in 1959 about the adventures of Admiral Byrd in the North Pole. He was hired by the U.S. government specifically to put a cloud over the whole Operation High Jump, and especially Admiral Byrd's flight not to the North Pole, but the real place, the South Pole, Antarctica. They tried to cover it up so bad, like you wouldn't believe. Like I said, if you change two words in his diary, from North to South, and Arctic to Antarctic, everything is dandy, isn't it?
That is incredible. Now, we're going to come back to Operation High Jump. So now, Earth Explorers, you've had a nice foundation. You know what Operation High Jump was, when it took place and where it took place. In our next hour, we are going to talk about why it took place, and it's pretty incredible. You don't want to miss this. Let's jump to the Fatima event. What happened there in 1917?
All right. Fatima event took place in Fatima, Portugal. Now, you asked me earlier about the name of the leader of the Nephilim.
Yes, I asked you what the boss's name was. Who was the leader of the Nephilim?
That leader His name today is called Lucifer. That's his name. He was also called Lucifer roughly 55,000 years ago when Nephilim fell to Earth. What you have to understand, the Nephilim were constructed of a space consortium. They consisted of three groups. And the Old Testament and the New Testament talk greatly about them. There were angelic entities called the cherubim, the ophanim, and the seraphim. Lucifer came from the Anunnaki sect. In the old days called him the angels, but they're not, of course. Lucifer is a great scientist. He's a super scientist. You have to realize that the Anunnaki are a race of super scientists specializing in DNAs. That's the whole specialty. Terraform planet and create life. And Lucifer was in charge of our galaxy, the Earth. It was his baby project. Now, the cherubim, the ophanim, and the seraphim are what's called in the Old Testament, in a religious term, angelic entities. In actuality, they are just another form of alien races. Now, the cherubim supposedly serve God, capital G, little g. So do the ophanim. But the ophanim serve a different purpose. In the Old Testament and New Testament, they're very rarely seen in their actual image. I believe that the Ophanim is a Hebrew word, so I do speak Hebrew, for a fun, wheel, Ophanim, bicycle. They can shapeshift themselves into spaceships. They are the ones who transport the cherubim and the seraphim between galaxies.
Ah, okay. I gotcha.
They can do that. They come from the seventh dimension. That's the legend, or that's the story from Sumerian tablets or from other sources. The seraphim and cherubim cannot. They come from a lower dimension. Maybe the fourth, I'm not really sure, I'm not an expert in that. The seraphim, the ophanim, can only travel on the surface of the planet that they are on. I guess it's got to do with magnetism, whatever. But the ophanim can travel between galaxies, and they can shapeshift to almost any form as transporters. They can shapeshift to I guess for example, either a small spaceship or a supersized spaceship to transport the cherubim and the seraphim. Now, Lucifer is from the sect the seraphim. The seraphim is the Hebrew word stand for seraph, fire, fiery, flames. Now here's a story about Fatima. In 1917 in Portugal, some shiny object was seen in the sky above town. It looked like a silvery coin, whatever. Silver coin, of course, as far as we know today, would be a flying saucer. Shining in the sky against the rays of the sun.
Mm-hmm. And there were witnesses.
There were witnesses. Now, supposedly, now what I'm going to tell you now is not known by very many, by very few people. But it's also known, I'm going to mention a name, by a person called Leo Zagami. He's an ex-Vatican insider who left the Vatican and is trying to spill the beans. And he verified what I'm going to tell you next. It's very critical. Most people heard about the three prophecies of Fatima. Three prophecies. That supposedly three girls saw. What allegedly happened is originally saw the shining disc in the sky, and a few minutes later, the three girls standing on some piece of farmland next to a barn or trees or whatever. Now, repeat, three girls. They saw an apparition come down from the sky, an apparition of a woman who looked like the Virgin Mary. Virgin Mary, again, it's a woman, female. That apparition of the Virgin Mary told the three little girls three prophecies who speak about happenings in the future. The attempt to kill the Pope, scandals in the Vatican, and fire coming down from the sky, either meteors or planet approaching, whatever. Great disasters. That's a normal thing that we know. What most people don't know, and maybe they heard it somewhere, but I'll bet you most people do not know what I'm going to tell you next. There was one more witness to the action that day. It was a little boy standing behind a farmhouse or a tree. I repeat, a boy, a male. He also saw an apparition. However, what he saw was not an apparition of the female Virgin Mary. He saw an apparition of a man, of a male, a man, who told him two things. Now, those things are very critical. Well, that apparition of the man told the little boy is, now here it comes, you're all my children. You're the children of Lucifer. So what he meant to say, now, you've got to be careful. Most religions think of the name Lucifer as the devil. This guy Lucifer is still around today on this planet. Even though he's imprisoned, he's full power on this planet. What he told the little boy is, you're all my children, the whole planet. We created you. I created you. That's exactly what he said. Now, well,
some would say that this is the genetic creation of the human body from existing DNA or existing animals or existing subhumans or primitive humans that were here. But the being inside, the eternal being that lives over and over again in the human body, is not his creation. That's what some would say.
That may be. But I'm hypothesizing that what he meant to say is that I created you, the human race, originally. You're all my children, either my children, great-great-children, great-great-great-great-children. You evolved from my original creation.
Okay. So now, did Pope John Paul II have anything to say about these prophecies?
He mentioned once, about 15 years ago, in one speech very quietly, about the first three prophecies to the girls. However, the prophecy involving the little boy was kept under wraps. Nobody's ever heard it before. It's a very, very few insiders. Very, very few. Almost nobody. It was hidden so strongly you wouldn't believe.
Very interesting. So the third prophecy that you were talking about, the close pass of a planet or a comet or some kind of sign like that in the heaven, some would say that Nibiru, or this brown dwarf, or this free-floating planet, or this planet that comes around every 3,600 years or so, is now approaching Earth and will very soon become visible to the naked eye. What kind of effects would this have on the Earth?
You're absolutely correct. As a matter of fact, the same Pope, the Vatican, about 2 years ago, leased, rented or leased or bought 7 observatories. Some in Argentina, close to Antarctica, Australia, Arizona, Africa, and other locations. For the sole purpose of verifying if there is such a planet, Nibiru. I understand, from my investigation, I understand that after those Vatican agents, the super-duper astronomers, came to those observatories, after only 2 weeks of looking at something, they left, they went right back to the Vatican. Apparently, they confirmed exactly the planet Nibiru indeed is approaching us. Not only that, the U.S. spy satellites verify the same thing. Exactly. They know it's coming. They know. But you see, since I told you earlier, the Vatican is working directly for the Nephilim. Those Nephilim cannot afford any hysteria of the people on planet Earth.
Well, it's a little bit like being pregnant, Aaron. I mean, sooner or later, everybody's going to notice.
That's correct. But until somebody wakes up one morning and looks at the horizon, and a little boy going to tell his mommy, "Hey, Mom, look. There are 2 suns out there. What's this?" So I guess until that point, they will try the best to hide it for a reason. They're trying to find something that will help them to escape of this planet by certain dates. And if they cannot keep order among our population for as long as they can, it may disrupt the whole plan. They got to be very careful. They're going to wait as long as they can until they let it out.
Well, you know, I'm not a naysayer here, but you know, we really haven't been a planet of order in a long, long time. We have been in some sort of global war or another for the last 100 years, and before that, you know, we were charging across the frozen tundra at one another with battle axes in hand. It would seem that if there are, you know, very comprehensive, all-knowing, or at least very experienced leaders behind the scene, that they have kept us at each other's throats for a long, long time.
That's true, except for one thing. I called the Nephilim today, the Seeing Eye on a dollar bill, the Seeing Eye Corporation. We heard about the Illuminati, the Bilderbergs, the Trilateral Commission. They are all the left and right hands of the Nephilim. They control our governments. They control the news. Our government cannot do anything. They're like puppets on a string. I don't care if it's the Russian government, the U.S. government, English or the French, or whoever. We all sound high and mighty. However, the orders come from a phone call or an email or whatever from somebody up above who gives the orders. It's like a pilot on a jet fighter who has to bomb a town or a city. He gets an order in his earphone. He doesn't know who's on the other side. But when he gets the order from a certain voice, he does what he's told. The same thing goes for our world leaders. They get certain orders from certain meetings, from certain groups, and they do exactly what they're told, not maybe the same day or not forcefully, but they build up a case publicly towards certain action pending those orders. And that's how it works.
Wow. Frightening and interesting at the same time. We have about 30 seconds left in this hour, so what we're going to do is go ahead and announce the phones again. We'll take about a four-minute break, allow those out there that are doing commercials to run those. The phone numbers are toll-free worldwide, 888-228-4494. And anywhere else, on planet, off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to us. It's 530-776-5154. Call in. Give us where you're calling from, your first name, and tell us what your question is. We'll be back in about 3 minutes with more Aaron Kaplan and his great book, Deep Analysis, Frightening Conclusion. You're going to love this. Don't go away.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned-up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship fly in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
The Alice Band, after the Gold Rush, Neil Young's great song. If you haven't made your fall plans yet, you might want to set some time aside, October 30th through November 1st, the Vortex Conference up in Burlington, Wisconsin. I can tell you right now, it'll be worth it. Some of the greats are going to be there. Jesse Marcel Jr. is going to be there talking about evidence that his father uncovered at Roswell. Don Schmidt, Tom Carey, all going to be there, and Stanton Friedman and myself. If you haven't been out to a convention and actually heard the facts from those who are writing it, those investigative reporters who are looking things up and finding things out and putting things together for you, that would be a good one to go to. It's if you want to know how to get there, just go to xsquaredradio.com and click on the Vortex Conference. The Burlington UFO Vortex Conference, October 30th through November 1st, and I promise you won't be let down. Also, if you're getting ready to start a business, if you're in business, if you're thinking about making your mark, you're going to need a business card. And what we're going to recommend is you go to X Squared Radio, click on the Vista Prints banner. In doing so, not only will you get your choice of 147 very nice backgrounds, But you'll also get 250 business cards, professionally printed, quickly delivered for free. Now, that's a great price. So if you want to make your mark, you're going to need a business card. Get there and get squared. We'll be back in 40 seconds with more Aaron Kaplan and his great book, Deep Analysis, Frightening Conclusions. Don't go away. We'll be back. Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. We're glad that you've tuned in and are getting squared. Deep Analysis, Frightening Conclusions, written by Aaron Kaplan. He's our guest tonight. Welcome back to the program, Aaron.
Oh, great to be here.
Oh, this is great stuff. Now, we laid a good foundation in the first hour. What we're talking about is the Nephilim, where they came from, how long they've been here, what their leader's name is, which is a little bit earth-shaking in itself. And there's a lot of information coming out. There's a new movie coming out called 2012, and certainly they're taking some artistic license with what a large gravitational body can do coming close to Earth, what this amazing gravitational plane is going to do to our planet as we're coming close to it. But 2012 has another significance, a significance that goes way back, a date that is very, very important to another race that happens to be living here on our planet or inside our planet. 2012 is important to them. Now, Sitchin says that one of Nibiru's moons collided with a planet called Tiamat and shattered it into what we know now as the asteroid belt. And Emmanuel Velikovsky backs that up, pretty much says the same thing. And it says he claims that even Tiamat had some pieces even crash to Earth as Nibiru dragged its broken body by. You mention in your book a fearful weapon called the Spear of Destiny. Tell us about that.
Right. The original assessment of the Karayat Sitkin, I read most of his books since 1976, and I believe that it's pretty very close to the actual truth. However, there is one more author called Mike Tesarian, and he came out to a slightly different angle. Slightly. He assessed in his assessment the planet Tiamat may not have been destroyed by Nibiru's satellites. May not have.
He had a different theory.
It's a different theory. The theory was that the planet was destroyed by the main Anunnaki race using a certain weapon while they were chasing those 200 Nephilim, while they were chasing them. Now, that's one theory. The other thing that's possible, is on the planet Nibiru. Now you have to realize that our galaxy, all of our planets rotate counterclockwise. There used to be a 12th planet called Tiamat that also rotated counterclockwise. The planet Tiamat was basically a water planet. When the sun was shining, it was like a very bright star because of the water reflecting the sunlight, the sun rays. when Planet Nibiru approached our galaxy that time, that instant, two things may have happened. The inhabitants of the planet Nibiru, which are the superiors of the planet Nephilim, the real big gods, the big boys, they were very upset. They thought that those planet Nephilim, before they came to Earth, were hiding somewhere on their planet. So out of fierce spite, or whatever the reason was, they destroyed that planet using a weapon called, which I believe, called the Spear of Destiny, or the and in conjunction with the Tablet of Destinies. The two parts to the weapon. There are two parts. It's very important to remember that. The Spear of Destiny and the Tablet of Destinies, per the Sumerian tablet text. Now, there could have been one more reason why the Anunnaki destroyed Tiamat. There could have been one more reason. Since Nibiru, its orbit, comes around the other side of the sun, it came around going clockwise. Now, you have to imagine, the planet rotates. If one is going clockwise, and the other is going counterclockwise, at super hyper speeds, you take only a few seconds to smash one into another. There is a possibility that the Anunnaki, who are citizens of planet Nibiru, realized, that if they don't destroy Tiamat very shortly, or almost instantly, they'll collide head-on into Tiamat. That Nibiru will collide head-on into Tiamat. Or Nibiru satellites, which will mean disaster for them anyway. They may not have had a choice, but to instantly vaporize Tiamat with that weapon, which happened roughly 55,000 years ago, approximately. Now here's another thing that I'm going to tell you that you won't hear anywhere else. It's very possible, I'm saying allegedly, it's a possibility that when planet Tiamat blew up, that either the ray or the whatever ray that weapon emits, could have reflected from the waters of Tiamat and also hit Mars. It's a possibility. Because we know that the planet Mars in the past had lots of water on it. Suddenly it disappeared. Nobody knows how. There is a certain atmosphere on Mars, but no visible water. Now what if, I'm just saying, I know it sounds way fetched, but what if the citizens of Nibiru, the Anunnaki, had to do what they did to save their own planet, and it did not take into consideration other factors? Mars could have been very close. It's like playing pool, billiard. You hit one ball, it'll hit two other balls. What if the death ray that is used from the Spear of Destiny and the Tablet of Destinies, what if part of it hit Mars by reflection? However, it did not destroy Mars. It only caused enough damage to vaporize the waters. It's a possibility.
Interesting. Now, what do you think caused the great flood on Earth that so many cultures write about?
There are two main floods. One happened roughly 55,000 years ago when Tiamat blew up. Like I said earlier, Tiamat was a water planet. when that planet blew into pieces, there are certain chemical reactions. Space is very cold. It's roughly between 225 and 400 degrees minus zero. It's very cold. It's like dry ice. As soon as water vaporizes in space, it freezes instantly. It becomes like dry ice particles. It's mixed in with the asteroid belt. Gravel, water, ice, whatever. Fish, frogs, etc. That water that was part of the asteroid belt formed its own orbit. It followed the orbit of the original planet Tiamat. Now, whenever certain planets come close to the asteroid belts, each planet has a gravity field. So does our Earth. Gravity is pretty strong. So apparently originally, most of the water that evaporated in space, that froze, on the first few passes, approximately 55,000 years ago, approximately, nobody can verify for sure when. Whenever the Earth came close to the asteroid belt, its gravity, magnetic forces, and other forces sucked in from the atmosphere by chemical reaction and gravity the frozen icicles of waters from that asteroid belt. After all, the water from planet Tiamat had to go somewhere. It stayed in the asteroid belt. So whenever our planet gets close to the orbit of the original Tiamat planet, it's sucked in the waters. Maybe not all the waters, but some of it. So in the first few passes, it sucked in so much water so quickly that it formed storms, cataclysm, etc., etc., etc. That was the first major flood. That's how the oceans were created, most of the oceans. Now, the second flood, of course, we know about. It's called Noah's flood. It was caused by a different reason. It was also caused by the approach of planet Nibiru, roughly 11,500 BC. When it came close to Earth, and the heat from the planet or the chemical reaction melted some ice in the South Pole by Antarctica, and the waters came rushing in. But the two different floods, they happened for two different reasons. You got to be very careful.
Makes sense that there would be some extraterrestrial water added to the equation. We have a caller online too, Ramon from New York. Welcome to the program.
How you doing, gentlemen? I actually might be able to somewhat verify his story on the ray gun or whatever kind of weapon they might have used that might have reflected and hit Mars. Are either one of you gentlemen familiar with Emmanuel, sorry, I can't pronounce his last name.
Emmanuel Velikovsky.
Yes.
His book, Worlds in Collision.
Yeah, he spoke about the scarred Mars and how they believe like Zeus basically threw his thunderbolts and scarred Mars and other planets. So is that what maybe the ancient Greeks were seeing or the ancient people that talked about this story and interpreted it that way? Hello?
It's very possible. You have to remember that years and years ago, people only repeated what they heard through legends, through stories from, you know, from father down to grandfather and so forth. But that weapon that I mentioned earlier and that you mentioned, which is pretty good, also resembles another weapon that's been mentioned in the Bible. I'm not sure whether I should mention it now or later.
No, it's good because we're getting right to that point where we're talking about whether this weapon exists or existed,
right,
and are we still looking for it?
Right. That weapon, by the way, the Spear of Destiny and Talisman of Destiny is a two-part weapon. It's here today. It existed in the days of Moses, and it exists today. And I know exactly where it is. I'm not going to say that, but the name is the Ark of the Covenant and the magic rod or the cane that Moses used. It's a two parts, the magic rod or the rods and the Ark of the Covenant. I believe they are the Spear of Destiny and the Tablet of Destinies. It's a very powerful weapon, and it's in existence today.
Do you think they're looking for it? I mean, is this something that the government is mounting, sort of an Indiana Jones-style all-out search party to try and find this weapon?
They found it. And I know exactly where it is.
Interesting. What do you think, Ramon?
Sometimes I get lost for words because it's... just when I think you guys can't really, take me a little further out, I end up going a little further out. But I'm very appreciative. Finally, somebody, many people who finally start to look at our part of the history that everybody else, I guess, throws out the information and says, oh, no, you know, those people were crazy back in ancient times. They don't know what they're talking about. Only we know what we're talking about. And I'm glad to see someone who's doing real study and not just being, what's the correct word, ignorant of saying, okay, only in modern times where are we able to do these kind of things, where, as me and you, Dr. Agnes, spoke before, it's been done over and over again. Who knows how many times we've reached this level and gone back, and I'm glad someone's digging deep into our history.
If you wish, I can tell you exactly where it is right now, but I'm not going to tell you how I arrived at the conclusion and how I arrived there. But I will tell you right now exactly where it is.
Okay, let's break the story. Go ahead.
It's in the hands of the State of Israel, and it's fully operational.
Well, I pity anybody.
Later on, I'll tell you a story exactly how we got there. Exactly, step by step.
Sounds frightening.
I'll keep listening on the internet, and thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks for calling, Ramon. So, okay, this great weapon exists. It's in the hands of Israeli army and... And they're prepared to use it. But it seems like far too powerful of a weapon to merely defend a nation against another nation. I mean, we can do that with jets and with various high-tech weaponry. This doesn't sound like a defensive weapon at all. It sounds like an offensive weapon. It sounds like a weapon that would be used not against an enemy on Earth, but an enemy off-planet. Does that sound accurate?
If you went to a supermarket in the old days, Sears, you know, the Sears tools department, and you
asked
for a wrench, you want to buy a wrench that fits all bolts, you could find a wrench with seven sides that they can be used for peaceful purposes, for attack, for defense, to cook food, to provide food, to create life, to destroy. At an instant, that's exactly what it is. It's not only a weapon. It's a super device that somehow interconnects through a portal to a different dimension to gather its power. But it can only be used now, again, no reference to a religious race, whether it's Christians or Jews, anybody. It can only be used by a certain person, now listen to this, with a certain DNA. It's very critical.
So it's a DNA-specific weapon and or a DNA-specific piece of technology. That's interesting because, you know, most races on our planet by now are pretty well mixed. I mean, there's just a very, very small amount of DNA that separates one race from another, except for Hebrews that have managed to keep their genetic lines pure. Their DNA has a different makeup than everyone else on the earth. That's been verified by human genome research. They have managed to keep, the mixing out of their DNA, and they've managed to keep it what they think is, or what they state is pure, and it is different than everyone else. Does this DNA makeup give them the ability to operate this weapon?
Yes. If you notice, in Europe, the British royal family is very careful when they marry. They only try to marry within the royalty. That's also to preserve a bloodline, but it's a different story. In the Jewish religion, we have two or three sects, modern Hebrews, Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox, and the Hasidim. As you know, Hasidim, the people that wear the black hats, the beards, the very religious people, they tend to preserve their bloodline through marriages within the group very carefully. That has been handed down from the days of Moses. And that has to do exactly with the Magic Rod and Yarkul the Covenant. Direct tie. Directly. Not the religion. I repeat. You can call the Jewish people meatballs, spaghettis, or whatever. They're Jewish by religion, the Hebrew, the Israelites. However, the real reason is God once gave him a name. The Hebrew name is, in the Old Testament, in Hebrew it's called Am Segula. It's two words. It means a very unique nation, unique people. No tie to religion or anything. It's very specialty people. And I believe what God meant then, again, God, capital G or little g, God, whoever spoke to them, meant to tell them they are very unique people because of their biological DNA. It's very critical. You have to remember that specifically.
Interesting. Well, let's take a look at the Great Pyramid and what it might have been used for. What was Moses doing with this complex?
Okay, what I'm going to tell you now is what I call in my book, The Missing Chapter of Exodus. I believe there's a missing chapter in the book of Exodus, and it is a direct tie to the pyramid, directly. If you look at a pyramid, there were stories long ago that on top of the pyramid there used to be a golden tip made of gold.
Mm-hmm.
And it was robbed by other nations, by thieves, whatever. I don't believe so. Those golden tips were a part of the pyramid's either defense weapon or offense weapon that ties in to the Ark of the Covenant and Magic Rod. Let me explain. The pyramid is built in the center geographical location of the earth, right? Dead center, in a mess. Let's say if you had a car stuck in the snow, in the ice, or on a pothole, and you had to tow the car away. You call a tow truck driver, and he put a hook or the chain on a specified place on a bumper, where it's specified to pick up the car. And the strongest part of the car, so the car wouldn't fall apart. Well, the same thing goes to the Great Pyramid of Giza. It's built at the center of the earth for one purpose. To push the earth, or pull the earth, as a tool. and let me explain. There were many theories about the pyramid. The shafts, the face one direction, the face the stars, the face Cyrus, the face Mars. It's all yuckety, yuckety, yuckety stuff. There's all different reasons for the shafts. They face this way, they face this way. No. What those shafts are vents. They are vents. Let me explain what the vents are for. When Moses was born as a baby, the Pharaoh ordered all the male baby Hebrews to be killed, but not the girls. Because someone told the Pharaoh that he saw a vision that, Israelite man will rise up and cause harm to the kingdom, whatever. So a little boy was born called Moses. His sister tried to save him. She put him in a small coffer, tiny ark made of bamboo and some waterproofing, and let him go in a waterway near the Pharaoh's castle. Now I'm going to mention this word. It's a very critical word. You have to remember that. It's a Hebrew word called Yeor. In English, it's spelled Y-E-O-R, Yeor. May Yeor means the water of the Yeor. Now, the Yeor means it's a part of the Nile River. Many people don't know that the Nile River is the only river in the world that flows from south to north. It's very critical. And the Pyramid of Giza and the Pharaoh's palaces are in certain areas where the water is very calm toward the shore. But if you pass that point, you will be swept away immediately to the Mediterranean Sea. Very strong currents, immediately. So Moses' sister placed the coffer with Moses in it right at the water of the Yeor, right next to the palace and the pyramid, right next to it. But the next day, or in the same day, the Pharaoh's daughter saw the little box, the baby. She took the baby home and raised it. It was Moses. When Moses was 40 years old, the story goes that he killed the guard. So Moses escaped to the Midian desert, which is in the Sinai desert, pretty south. Now, Moses was not just a servant in a Pharaoh's palace. There are stories that Moses himself could have been a junior pharaoh, very high-ranking officer. We're not really sure. But anyway, when he was 40 years old, he escaped to the Midian desert. Now, when he was in the Midian desert, he got a job as a sheep herder. The local priest. The priest happened to be a black person. And he had a beautiful black daughter. She was also black. So apparently Moses fell in love with her, and he married her. Now, Moses was already a married man. He married somebody else in Egypt. So he was already married. So when he fled to the Midian desert, he married again, the daughter of the priest. The woman was black. That's very important to remember later on. She was black from Ethiopia. Just remember, folks, it's very important for the story. It's critical. Now, one day Moses goes, herding sheep in the mountains, and he sees the famous burning bush that we all read in the Bible, the Old Testament or New Testament. God speaks to him. God tells him something very strange out of nowhere. That he knew his forefathers. He knew Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God told him those words as per the Bible. That's very strange. Why would God tell Moses that?
Well, to let him know that his genealogy was important, to let him know that the purity of that DNA line was of utmost importance.
Exactly. He gave Moses a hint whether wanting to or not. Moses may not have understood that, but what God tried to tell him is, I'm watching those people. I watch them for a long time because they carry a certain DNA for a reason. Now, let's do this for a reason. And so are you, Moses. I'm going to choose you for the reason because you carry the DNA for that exact same reason. Now, listen, now, just follow me very carefully here. He takes Moses and trains him in a cave how to use the magic cane, the magic rod. He didn't train him for one day. He trained him for 40 years. For 40 years, on and off, on and off, on and off. He got a lot of training, Moses, with his magic rod. Now, at the end of the training, 40 years go by, with Moses being in the desert, suddenly God tells him, you know what, Moses? It's time to go to Egypt to take you people out, the Israelites. Now, isn't it strange? God tells Moses after 40 years, you know, now it's time to go to Egypt. Now, this coincides, when Moses was 80 years old, this coincides exactly, I mean not exactly, but pretty close, listen to this, very close to the day when the planet Nibiru was approaching the Earth. Isn't that strange?
That is strange, that it's way too much of a coincidence that Nibiru is coming close and Moses is at the peak of his training of how to use the magic staff.
So, of course, God promises Moses, look, go to Egypt. I'm going to tell you what to do. You're going to impress the Pharaohs, and they're going to release all your friends, the Israelites, the Jews. Well, there were no Jewish people then. Well, yeah, they were from Isaac. The son of Abraham, Isaac, theoretically, was the first Jew. And I'm going to help you take the people out of Egypt. But God
sounds
told
like
him
a,
one more thing.
It sounds like a clever ruse to me. It sounds like they were using Moses as a human trainee with the right DNA, how to use a very special weapon for a very
Bingo.
Special purpose.
Exactly, exactly. But Moses didn't know that. See, he didn't know that. Now, Moses comes to Egypt with the magic rod. Magic rod goes to the Pharaoh's palaces, and we all remember the snake tricks. The big snake eats a small snake, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
But that's not all Moses did. Now, listen to this. Now, as we know, Moses did not possess the Ark of the Covenant yet. He only received it from God on the way out of Egypt with the Israelites when he stopped back again at Mount Sinai. Because God told him, when he gave him the magic rod to go to Egypt, just remember, when you come out of Egypt with the Israelites, stop here on your way out. Stop here, the same place, at Mount Sinai. I have to give you something. Okay? So Moses never heard of the Ark of the Covenant. All he knows, he had the magic rod that he was trained to use. Now, this is very tricky. People have to hear that. In the holiday of Passover, in Jewish religion, in the first night, it's called the Seder. That's the Passover holiday for the Jewish people. At the first night, the head of the table or the rabbi takes a glass of wine, and he puts a few drops on the plate, and he calls a few names like blood, locust, blah, 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 blah. in the Old Testament, if you remember, when Moses came to the Pharaoh to release the Israelites, he performed some magic tricks. When the first tricks failed, when the first threat failed, the water turns to red blood. Then the Egyptians were threatened by frogs and lice and flies and boils and hail and so forth. But just follow me. Just follow me what I'm going to say. Number one, blood, frogs, lice, flies, disease of livestock, boils, hails, locusts, and 3 days of darkness. Remember the order, what I just mentioned. It's very important. Now, what happened down in the pyramids? What did Moses do? Before I go on with the story, I'll take a time machine 40 years in the future. That's very important. Very critical.
Okay.
After Moses left Egypt with the Israelites, they went through the desert. They were fed manna and they were fed water. Supposedly from UFOs. Supposedly. We can't verify it. But by all sources of information that we have now, they were UFOs. Whether they were flying saucers or flying ships, whatever. They were fed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just before Moses reached the land of Canaan, the Israelites started to yell at him, "Hey, Moses, we're starving, we're thirsty, we have no water. What do we do?" Moses panicked. I said, "What do you do?" He went to God. Again, God. Big G, little G, whatever. I went to the person that Moses knew as God. And he asked God, "God, what do I do?" So God told him something very critical. Now you got to listen to this. The Old Testament and the New Testament differ. What I'm going to tell you is very critical. God told, the New Testament says that God told Moses, "Go and do what you did 40 years ago at the river." That's the New Testament. However, the Old Testament, God tells Moses, "Go and do exactly what you did at the Yeor." Remember I told you before about the word Yeor?
Right, right.
The water right next to the pyramid?
Uh-huh.
Do exactly what you did at the Yeor. Now remember, Moses right now is not asking for any tricks of snakes or frogs, anything. He's asking to get water out of the ground. He wants water to rise out of the ground. Now, what did Moses do at the Yeor to get water out of the ground? Now listen very carefully. Here's apparently what happened. Now we're going back to 40 years of Moses went to Egypt originally with the magic tricks. Here's what happened. Unknown to Moses, an Ark of the Covenant, was placed inside the pyramid from a previous leader. Just like Moses, but not by Moses. From a previous leader, 3,600 years ago. Now, in the Great Pyramid of Giza, there are a few chambers. The Queen Chamber, the King Chamber, and the other chambers. In the King Chamber, right almost in the middle of the room, or close to a wall, there's a coffer made of black marble. This opening of the black coffer has the same exact measurements, identical, for male or female fit to the Ark of the Covenant. And the measurements are described in the Old Testament. The same exact measurement within a millimeter male fit to female fit. Gyaku fit right inside the copper opening, exactly. Now, a few years ago, if you remember, if you watch television, courtesy of Dr. Zahi Hawass, the great Egyptian archaeologist who's in charge of all the pyramids and stuff, has allowed a team of American researchers to enter the pyramid. They entered with a small so-called Radio Shack vehicle with chains.
Right, right.
Like a little tractor. And it took TV pictures of the shafts going up toward the tip of the pyramid.
Right.
What did we see?
Well, they got to the top and they found a little blockage, a wall.
Not exactly. Every few feet, they saw worn out on aged copper plug on the walls.
Right.
Especially at the end, like copper conduits. And they led straight to the top. The same copper conduits existed in the king chamber, right next to the copper, where supposedly the Ark of the Covenant fits in exactly. They are right on the wall, next to the copper, like plugs. A year or two later, they allowed another team in, and they took x-rays of the pyramid, of the walls. You know what they found? They found huge copper lines, what I call them lines or tubing, like an inch or two thick, made of copper, going straight up from the king chamber, from those conduits on the wall, straight up to the tip of the pyramid.
Okay. So was this copper connecting the interior of the pyramid to something else?
Well, do you know how a spark plug works in a car?
Sure.
Right. There's a positive and negative, or the way it's built. And if you take the pyramid, and if you take an imaginary, what I mentioned earlier, the golden tip, place it on the top of the pyramid, and it's connected by a copper line, go straight down to the king chamber, what do you need to power it now? You need a power source. Giant battery. Or whatever. Generator or battery. And guess what the generator or the battery is? The Ark of the Covenant.
I got you. Okay, so now this unit, this whole unit put together, the Ark of the Covenant is the power source, the pyramid is the focusing unit, the pyramid strategically placed in the center of all land masses of the earth. You said earlier the combination of which was used to either push or pull the earth. Did they actually do it? Did they actually move the earth, and why?
Yes, it did, and it's exactly what happened. Now remember, Moses trained 40 years for that exact job. See, he didn't know that the Ark of the Covenant is already inside a pyramid. Not the one that he was going to receive a few weeks later, the Israelites on the way out, but one already existed inside the pyramid. He didn't know that.
Sure. Yeah, it was probably there for 7,000 years before he got there.
3,600 years. The last time it was used.
Okay.
Now, here's what happened. There's also a story about Moses that before he came to the pyramid, he put his wrist inside his vest, and the inside of his wrist, his arm turned white, like leprosy. Do you remember that?
Right.
Okay. To me, this is a cleansing of the inside skin. To make sure that his arm is clean inside. Why? To make a perfect fit to the magic rod. Like I told you earlier, that magic rod is very sensitive to DNA. Only certain people can use it. So So apparently God had a process where Moses' arm, the inside of his wrist, is clean. Like when they take a blood test today, they take it from inside your wrist. Very thin skin. This is a very sensitive area of the skin where if you hold the magic rod against it, it'll apparently be activated right away because it'll know that the right person is using it. Remember, it was Nephilim and Lucifer, a DNA specialist, the experts. That's all they live for and operate. DNA, the experts. So all their weapons is built around DNA. So now we have Moses with a clean hand, with a magic rod.
And the right DNA to wield it.
That's correct. And here's what happened. Moses stood by the pyramids on the banks of the river, waved the rod in the air. Whatever action it did, whether he pressed the button, waved the rod, we're not sure. The Bible says he waved his, you know, he always waved the rod in his hand. So we'll take it as that. He could have pressed the button, you know what I'm saying, or whatever. But he waved the rod. What happened that instant, he activated the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant started to operate and draw super energy from a porthole from another dimension. Superpower. Electricity or whatever. The old pyramid became one giant spark plug or one giant power beam aimed at Nibiru. Not in a bad way. Now remember, not to destroy Nibiru, just to give as a pushing action. I'm not sure whether to push Nibiru away from the earth or the earth away from Nibiru. Just enough to nudge it, to push it aside from collision or from catastrophic weather effect.
Now, were these the good guys training Moses? These were the occupants of Nibiru training Moses to prevent Nibiru from colliding with Earth or from coming so close to Earth that it would cause great cataclysms? Or was this training from the banished ones to Moses, trying to teach him to do something to Nibiru?
They were training from the banished ones. That's all he knew. But remember, banished ones or non-banished ones, neither side was interested in damage. Especially for the 200 Nephilim that were here, the banished ones, they had to survive. They had to survive. The same way they have to survive this coming cataclysm in 2012. The banished ones, I believe, built the pyramids right after they were banished here. Of the few passes of the home planet Nibiru, we saw what's going on maybe 50, 40,000 years ago. That's when the pyramid was built, roughly, for that purpose. They knew they had to build it. Or else. So back to the story, what Moses did, when he waved the magic rod, he activated the Ark of the Covenant. Now it became a powerhouse. It provided all the juice that was needed for this operation. Either push the earth a little bit, or nudge, or whatever. It worked. However, while the process was going on, apparently, the Ark of the Covenant was getting red hot. Like a racing engine. It needs a radiator. So what did Moses do by the order of God with the magic rod again? Remember, it was at the Yaor. That was the area was cold. He waved the rod again. And a huge volume of water came from underneath the pyramids to the hidden shafts, right after the king chamber to cool off the Ark of the Covenant. And guess who all the excess water went through? The venting shafts.
Right up the venting shaft, sure. And that's
right
why
up. In and out, in and out, in and out. Now you have to remember this. What was in the water that cooled off the Ark of the Covenant. It came from the river. It contained livestock, fish, frogs, little animals, birds, whatever. So as soon as the boiling venting water came out of the shafts, it spewed all the junk out. It looked like bloody water. That's exactly what it was. And after bloody water gets spewed out from the shafts, what happens? The frogs on the shore, remember, frogs are very clean animals. You'll never find a frog in dirty pools. That's with very
right,
clean water.
Right. Very sensitive.
Those frogs
to ecology.
Jump deeper into land and invaded people's homes. They had no choice. That's exactly what the Old Testament says. Blood, frogs, then came the lice. All the bloody mess and stew, now you have lice and flies. Then disease of livestock. And your skin boils from acid rain. And that tip was sparking for a couple of days. We know how long it sparked, for hours or days. And dirty water rained in your body. It caused boils. Then came hail. In most electrical storms, which is caused by the rain, it created hail.
So what are we going to do this time when Nibiru comes around? Are we going to give it another shove, or is it going to come closer, or is it going to miss us by a long way?
Apparently, data that I've read from you know, super-duper scientific articles, I say super-duper, you know what I mean, the planet Nibiru will pass us at our near side of the sun. In other words, pretty close to us. So what I'm guessing, if the Israelites possess the Ark of the Covenant, and I'm pretty sure they do, something will happen where it's going to find itself back in the pyramid. Now, wouldn't it be funny if a company named Halliburton suddenly gets a contract to perform some cosmetic work on a pyramid soon? I repeat, cosmetic?
Yeah.
Right? On the hidden, you know, cover-up to rebuild the pyramid. And I'm thinking where the golden tips are hidden. Couldn't it be maybe inside of Sphinx chambers? Or maybe somewhere in Iraq? Maybe? I don't know. I'm just taking a guess. But something will happen very soon, next year or two, you'll see. Either Halliburton or another company will get an order to form cosmetic surgery in a pyramid. Cosmetic. That's coming.
Well, somebody knows what's going on. In your book, you talk about some very strange deaths of certain people. Not the least of which is Princess Diane. Can you tell us about some statements that she made as before she left the living?
Yeah. Many people don't like to discuss that, but I'll mention a few words because it happened. It's public facts. Nobody wants to discuss the reptilians. Nobody. Apparently, it's a very scary subject. It seems to be that the Anunnaki are super shapeshifters. They can shapeshift on the dime. They may be, I'm saying only allegedly, they may be part reptilian. Maybe.
So what did Princess Diane say that led us to believe that?
The public story is, you know, she got pregnant from an Arabian prince or king or whatever, blah, 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 blah. That's not true. Only 2-3 months before she was killed, died, she made a few public statements about a British royal family. Now you can play the tapes back. Like Warner Wolf says, play the tapes. Here's what you said. They are a bunch of freaking lizards. The whole bunch of them. A bunch of freaking lizards. She found them out. She married them. She slept with them. She knew.
Wow.
And a month later, she was killed. She said it in public. It's on record. She called them a bunch of freaking lizards.
Now, what did John E. Mack find out? He was a Harvard psychologist. What was he working on that backed
this up? That's correct. For a few years, he was working on alien abductions, trying to solve cases. However, in the last few months of his research, he concentrated on reptilians. And he went to England to give a speech about reptilians. Accidentally, he steps off supposedly a sidewalk and gets hit by a car.
Wow. What a coincidence. And there's a third one, and this we're talking about royalty, we're talking about or psychologist, and now we have a U.S. geologist, Gene Shoemaker, of Shoemaker-Levy fame. What was he working on, and what happened to him?
Did you hear lately that our country wants to make a tiny hole in the moon to find water? Soon they want to launch a missile at the moon or whatever?
That's right, the LCROSS mission, 28th of next month. They're going to drop a 3,600-pound projectile at about 6,000 miles an hour right onto the moon to make an artificial crater to see if there's water under the surface of the moon. Sounds like a really crazy way to find this out. I mean, couldn't we just land a rover and drill into it and find out if it had water?
Well, I'm going to give you an answer in Russian, and the word is нет, нет. That's not what a hole is for. They know there's water there. Shoemaker found out about it years ago. Remember, he trained astronauts how to find water on the moon on a project called Project Clementine. He trained astronauts. He found out there is water on the moon. They know there's water on the moon for years. They also know that the moon is artificial. It's artificial.
What does that mean?
That means that big hole in the moon that's going to be done soon is not to find water. They're going to destroy something, which I'll discuss later on. They're there to destroy something that ties directly to Roswell. I mean, directly.
Mm-hmm.
It's frightening.
Well, the plot thickens. Okay, Earth Explorers, the end of the second hour. You don't want to miss this third hour. Trust me, the mystery that we have been unraveling, Aaron Kaplan and his book, and this is an amazing book. If you get a chance, I want you to go out and buy this book. It's called Deep Analysis, Frightening Conclusion. The author's Aaron Kaplan. It's about 200 pages. Read it in an afternoon because you won't be able to put it down. We'll be back in about 3 minutes, 30 seconds with more. Mystery, don't go away. We'll be right back. Squared Radio. We're so glad that you're here with us tonight. We're beginning our third hour. This is a three-hour radio program. If you're not getting all 3 hours, please let us know. Give us the call letters of that station, and we'll get with them and make sure you're getting the full 3 hours, because you don't want to miss a thing. This is the hour that we really begin to delve into the deep mysteries, tile things together. We've been laying foundations for the last couple of hours with our guest, Aaron Kaplan. His book is called Deep Analysis, Frightening Conclusion. Aaron, do you have a website?
Yes, I do. At the website to check my book or buy it is deepanalysisfrightingconclusion.com. Or you can just email to my publisher, www.libris.com. It's XLIBRIS.com. Or if you don't have internet and you want to use telephone, you can dial 888-795-4274.
All right, Earth Explorers, we are about to tie all this together and make it all make sense. The ancient, the current, and the future. And you don't want to miss a thing. We'll be back in 40 seconds with more X Squared Radio. Explorers, third and final hour of X Squared Radio with our guest Aaron Kaplan. We've been talking about pyramids, Nephilim, Nibiru, close passes, and cataclysmic events. But it all has a reason, it all has a piece in what we're about to talk about. Aaron, we know that there are a lot of strange weapon systems have been developed in the last 50 or 60 years. We don't really know why. We don't know all of the pieces, how everything ties together and why. Toward the beginning, or the precursor events prior to World War II, we know that people were working on nuclear weapons technologies. We know that the Nazis were working on an atomic bomb about the same time we were working on one. Tell us what was really going on here. I mean, you had two nations simultaneously developing a terrible weapon system who were enemies, and yet something very amazing happened that I'll bet our listeners don't know.
No, what I'm going to tell you next, nobody knows, and I hope it's not, revealing too much, but it's something amazing. It seems that back in 1936, those aliens in Nephilim signed a treaty with the Germans, with the Nazis, in the Black Forest in Germany. A treaty towards something. We're not sure yet. 4 years later, those same Nephilim signed a treaty with the U.S., with President Roosevelt. I repeat, 4 years later. That's one reason, I believe, why the Germans, their military advancement, was exactly 4 years ahead of us. Their weaponry in the beginning of World War II was awesome. The tanks, the ships, the planes, we couldn't match it. That's only because they signed the treaty 4 years earlier. You see, those Nephilim, they're like vampires. Vampires can enter your house, suck your blood, whatever. But they do things legally. It's like a vampire coming to your window, knocks on your window and says, "Let me in, please." Once you let them in, that's it. Once you sign a treaty, they own you, legally. No fear. That's what they did with the Axis, the Germans, and the Allies, Americans, and English. What those aliens did in World War II, previously too, but especially in World War II, they knew it's coming to a hedge. They had to assure themselves that whatever the goal is, it'll be done two ways in parallel. If one fails, the other one will succeed. So they used the Axis, the German Nazis, and us toward the same goal, to build a nuclear bomb. We, the Americans or the Germans, didn't know that we were working basically on the same project, but from a different angle. Of course, our top leaders above our presidents were the so-called Illuminati Trilateral Commission or Bilderberg. They knew. But our real leaders and our real generals didn't know. Now, get this.
Okay, keep going.
Now, Albert Einstein sent President Roosevelt a letter in 1939 that he knew the Germans started to work on atomic bomb. He advised Roosevelt that he also must start a project to develop an atomic bomb. Roosevelt listened to Einstein. So in 1941, we started what's called the Manhattan Project. We didn't know that at the same time, or 4 years earlier, the Germans already started their project. They are ahead of us a few years. And just listen what's coming. The head of the Manhattan Project was Dr. J. Robert Oppenheimer. Even then, we had a small tie to Germany. It was very innocent, but we did. And it's not by accident. Somebody above and beyond, made sure that Dr. Robert Oppenheimer was in Germany learning something from their knowledge. Dr. Robert Oppenheimer learned at the University of Göttingen in Germany from 1926 to 1928. He was a student there. That's where he got his degree. Very few people know that. He started in Germany under a professor called Max Born, a German professor. So for two whole years, an American scientist trained in Germany with their scientists. So he already knew in his heart, he didn't know what's going on, but he was already taught what he was supposed to learn. Do you understand? Somehow.
Yeah. Yes. Now, if the Germans had been developing their bomb program 4 years before us, then that means that they were able to develop enriched uranium 4 years ahead of us.
Well, here's the problem. Here's the problem. Yes, they did. They developed enriched uranium. But here's the problem. When Dr. Oppenheimer was told to build an atomic bomb in this country, he was told flat out, we do not have enriched uranium. We cannot build an atomic bomb with uranium. You have to build the atomic bomb around plutonium, which is a byproduct of uranium waste. Now, that's very important. Dr. Oppenheimer and the Manhattan Project built an atomic bomb, it designed an atomic bomb to be used around plutonium, not uranium. That's a fact. Now, in my book, you folks probably don't have it, but on page 85, I have what's called a nuclear calendar chart.
I have it open to right now. This is the most amazing timeline. It's unbelievable, folks. This is absolute history in perspective, like you have never seen it before. One page, it outlines what Aaron calls the nuclear calendar. This is the most stunning series of events. You will not believe it. Now, let's get started with it, Aaron. How does it go?
Now, the Germans blew up a nuclear device on October 12, 1944. Location is Rügen Island in Germany. Two nuclear explosions. Type was unknown at the time. March 3, 1945. In Thuringia, Germany. There was not a nuclear explosion. That we know they used uranium-235. Now, when you design a nuclear weapon using uranium, you have to use what's known as a gun-type trigger device. It's different than a plutonium bomb. Now, a few months later, on May 7th, 45, Germany surrenders. Now, you have to remember, Germany built the nuclear bomb with uranium using heavy water developed in Norway. We all know the big expedition the English had to invade Norway to destroy those heavy water plants. The Germans developed heavy water plants in Norway. Now, May 17, right after Germany surrenders, May 17, 45, a U-boat, number 234, the ID number of the U-boat, and I know exactly of the evidence. The U-234 headed toward the U.S., loaded with nuclear parts. Just keep it in mind, folks. June 1st, 45, 1 month later, is the approximate date the German sub, the same number, 234, arrived in New Hampshire, USA. Now, two submarines arrived at the same week. One of them was 234. June 1st, 45, the submarine, one submarine arrived in New Hampshire, that 234. Now, July 16th, we had our first nuclear test at Trinity, USA. The Trinity test was the world's first known atomic blast. But they used plutonium. There was our bomb. We built this bomb with our plutonium. But our plutonium bomb used an impulsion-type trigger. Remember, we did not have uranium. We only built a plutonium bomb in Trinity for our first test.
Well, now, this is interesting because you're saying that on October 12th, there were two nuclear explosions on Rügen Island by Germany. This means that Germany was really the first country to test a nuclear weapon. And they didn't do it once. They did it three times before Trinity.
That's correct.
And these were all using uranium-type weapons with the gun-type trigger. Now, a lot of people don't know what a gun-type trigger is. Basically, this is a tube, and you have two pieces of uranium, and you shoot them at each other inside the tube. And what it does, it forces the uranium close together in a situation called criticality, and you have a nuclear chain reaction that turns into an atom bomb. The plutonium device with an implosion-type trigger is a shaped charge that is around the plutonium, and it literally crushes it like crushing a basketball to the size of a walnut, and this is what creates the criticality. Two completely different trigger devices, two completely different levels of precision, and two different fuels, and two countries working on atomic bombs with different trigger devices and different fuels is statistically impossible. This had to come from higher technology.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, absolutely right. And right after we exploded our first test bomb at Trinity, which was July 16th, very quickly afterwards, on August 6th, that's almost what, 2 weeks or 3 weeks, we dropped a bomb on Hiroshima, Japan, named Little Boy, from B-29, called the Enola Gay. Now remember, it's August 6th. That bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima, Little Boy, was not the same plutonium bomb that we tested at Trinity. It was U-235 uranium bomb with a gun-type trigger.
Well, now, Aaron, there's a discrepancy here. How in the world did a U.S. atom bomb called Little Boy end up with enriched uranium and a gun-type trigger? We didn't have it.
Right. I'll explain in 1 minute. There was an August 6th on Hiroshima who dropped a uranium bomb. Now, remember, we tested one on Trinity, plutonium. 3 weeks afterwards, it dropped on Hiroshima, uranium. And 3 days later, August 9th, we dropped one over Nagasaki named Fat Man Plutonium. It was our bomb. The bomb that was dropped over Hiroshima, the guts of the bomb, the uranium slugs, and the trigger came from U-boat 234 from Germany.
All right, now, this really smacks of corroboration between these two countries, and I'll tell you why. The casing, the actual shape of Little Boy, was already built. All that was done, and it was delivered to the airport in front of the Enola Gay and ready to be loaded. You're looking at a time difference here between May 17th and August 6th of 2 months. There's no possible way that bomb could have been built in 2 months. It was built ahead of time, which means the mechanism that was built in Germany had to be built to specific specifications. How did that happen if they weren't working together?
Exactly. You got it right in the nose. Not only that, just before the Enola Gay took off to bomb Hiroshima, do you know that they sort of toyed around with the bomb supposedly for almost 4 days on practice runs on the runway? And they've seen very strange boxes on the runway, wooden crates of parts, painted out numbers, and scientists are working on a bomb on the side, and only in the last minute, the real bomb was loaded on the plane. At the last second in Tinian Island, the last second.
Now, the interesting thing about this is we had never detonated anything like this before. We had no idea that it would work. At least American scientists didn't. And yet it was flown over Hiroshima and dropped.
That's right. Hey, you got it. You got it. We never tested uranium bomb. I mean, to build a uranium bomb, you need another team of scientists at a separate project totally. I mean, totally. It's a new ball game.
Yeah, this is very interesting because what we have here is a major discrepancy in history. And what it implies is that there was a higher order, a higher government that was working with Germany and with the United States at the same time, but there's even more. What else was on U-234 when it arrived in New Hampshire?
On U-234, supposedly, they found two dead Japanese scientists. Supposedly. I don't believe they were dead. I believe they were drugged to look like dead. To look like dead.
So all three nations that were pounding the heck out of the world, racing toward each other like freight trains, developing nuclear weapons, were all together in the same port at the same time exchanging nuclear technology. Aaron, what's going on?
Well, what's going on is those controllers, our supercontrollers, the string pullers, had to make sure they had to make sure that at least one of the atomic bombs succeeds and blows up for a reason. Those Nephilim found out somewhere in the mid-1500s, they found out from certain sources, they had spaceships and spacecrafts hidden on the ground. But you have to remember that after Noah's flood, they lived in areas called Atlantis, Lemuria, with ancient names. Maybe true, maybe not true. But that flood from Noah, when our planet tilted slightly to avert a collision Nibiru or the storms, there may have been a war going on at the same time between the two alien races, the Nephilim, who were banished here, and the controllers when Nibiru arrived. There may have been a super war going on at the time. All that action with a super nuclear war and the tilting on the planet caused more cataclysm. The scientific labs, the storage places, their fuels were destroyed. Even their ability. If you remember in the Bible, it says, originally, when they arrived at Nephilim, they shed their skins. They shed their skins to intermingle with the women of Earth. Well, shed the skin doesn't mean take off your skin like a mask on Halloween and put new skin on. It refers to DNA. Those Nephilim were super DNA experts, like I explained before. They used their knowledge to convert their bodies to match humans in order for them to enjoy the pleasures of the earthly woman. However, after the cataclysm, apparently, with all their knowledge, they lost all their laboratories. They could not, for the last 13,500 years, they could not find a way to reverse, to recreate themselves to the original form. Because they lost their scientific ability. It's like a soldier in a field with a rifle. He has a rifle, a machine gun, MK-47, M-16, whatever. What does he do with it if he has no bullets? He's useless.
Yeah, it doesn't even make a very effective club. You know, there's more to this timeline than that's really going to wrap this story up and really tell it clearly. You know, on May 17th, 1945, U-234 arrived in New Hampshire, but August 17th, 1945, another submarine arrived in Argentina. But what the heck is the story about that U-boat?
Oh, that's a very famous U-boat that helped Hitler escape from Europe.
Where did he escape to?
He escaped to the place we discussed earlier, where Admiral Byrd was with Operation Highjump, Antarctica.
So he escapes in the summer of 1945 from Europe, while the rest of the world is led to believe that he committed suicide outside of a bunker. And so he escapes in the summer of 1945, and in the summer of 1946, what gets planned?
What gets planned is a very innocent scientific expedition called Operation High Jump to Antarctica to take pictures of the land, of the horizon, to make beautiful maps. The mission was equipped and was supposed to last for 8 months. But what's a peaceful mission doing with it? Three aircraft carriers full of fighters and 40 ships and between 4,000 and 5,000 men, fully equipped to the hilt. American soldiers, American Navy, Russian soldiers, Australian soldiers, English soldiers, New Zealand, and who knows what else.
Doesn't sound like a scientific mission to me. Doesn't sound like a scientific mission to me. Sounds like a military mission.
Exactly. That mission was equipped to the hilt to try to extract in secret, not only Hitler, but the Germans living in Antarctica. The reason why it was done in secret is very simple. If the word came out to the world that the Germans succeeded in forming another Germany in Antarctica, then the world, or we the Americans at least, would have no choice but to declare another war. We didn't want to do that. We wanted to go in secret, extract the Nazis, and very quickly, and goodbye Charlie. But it's not what happened. It's not what happened. We never expected to find Antarctica where we did, what we found. And here's what happened. Apparently in 1936, when the Germans first signed the treaty with the aliens, those aliens used the Nazis and us for a purpose, to develop the atomic bomb. Apparently those aliens are using the atomic bomb whenever they blow up in the air. They have a way of extracting the energy from the atomic bomb in some kind of a reverse process to create fuel for the spaceships. Just like in science fiction movies. The more atomic bombs you blow up, the more energy you extract. But we didn't know that. So our warriors, Admiral Byrd, Secretary of the Navy, James Forrestal, Admiral Nimitz, Admiral Krosner, they all go down to Antarctica. Remember, all those guys were American heroes. They were getting their strings pulled too. They didn't know what's really going on in Antarctica. Very few people know about them. So here we are, Operation High Jump. We're going to Antarctica to extract Nazis. Fine. On the way down to Antarctica, we go to icy waters, everything's fine. Suddenly we see UFOs flying above us at very high speeds, very peacefully. Nobody was shooting at anybody. This went on for a few days, super high speeds. And from the aircraft carrier, the Philippine Sea, Admiral Byrd took off for the 6 DC-3 converter to R-4Ds, those pipelines, and those 6 R-4Ds took off to Little America for photographic missions. Fine. As soon as those 6 planes took off, remember, they were tied to the carrier deck with chains. Our fighter planes could not take off from the carrier while those planes were tied to the chain to the deck. But as soon as those planes took off, and the first one was piloted by Admiral Byrd, the first one, he was there. That carrier turned around, and the action started against the Nazis. As soon as the action started against the Nazis, all hell broke loose. Those UFOs came out of nowhere. Now, there were two types of flying saucers. Two types. One, very smooth all around, very smooth. They were flown by the aliens. The alien never fired at us. However, there was another set of UFOs, flying saucers, that did fire at us. They were equipped with little guns on the bottom of the belly and on top. It looked like twin anti-aircraft guns. They were not cannons. They were sort of sound ray guns. They were built for them by the aliens. A few of those were actually seen at the end of World War II on top of a few German tanks. We didn't know where they were. I believe Russia caught one of them and tried to experiment with them. They couldn't. The Russians only found out how it works about 3-4 years ago, believe it or not, after all those years. So anyway, those German UFOs, they were operated by the Germans. They almost destroyed half of our Navy. It seems that every time we attack them, they turn the firepower furiously at us, causing great damage. Every time we stop firing, they stopped. So apparently the aliens were controlling them through a defense mode only. They will not let the Germans go on the offense. As soon as we stopped firing, they stopped. After 2.5 weeks on that, like I said, we lost almost half of our Navy. We turned around with a tail between our legs and virtually escaped our lives. We lost about 10 ships sunk, and the rest of them, when we returned to the U.S., were told to dock at nighttime. They were so badly damaged. They were torched and destroyed.
So the American public never knew about this. When the ships come back, 4-inch armor sliced through like it was butter, planes lost, holes cut into stuff all over the place. They sailed in under cover of darkness and just scrapped the ships and never took them back out to sea again.
That's correct. And if you read the log, I checked the log books of 10 ships, the names, including the Casablanca aircraft carrier. If you follow history, I checked the 10 warships, and some very strange. It seemed to all decommissioned 6 months before Operation High Jump, and they all sold or destroyed 2 weeks before Operation High Jump. You believe that?
Well, so officially, they didn't even exist when they took off for this mission.
That's correct. Except
1947 has another significance. All this takes place in the early parts, January and February of 1947. They arrive down in the Canal Zone. They are divided into two groups, a Western group and an Eastern group. They go down, and by March, they're back. And a strange thing happens in the summer of 1947. Now, one question I'm going to ask you, because you alluded to this in the book, and I want to know if you have any more information on it. Did these ships go down there with nuclear weapons?
Yes, it did. One ship, I'm not sure which one, but I believe it was the aircraft carrier of the Philippine Sea, the one that the six RDs were on, carried three nuclear weapons. However, those weapons were never used. Now, here's a story with them, a very frightening story, very amazing story, actually. Those three weapons somehow were hidden in secret very close to the entrance of the underground frozen cave of the Nazis, probably to be used at a future date, probably. But from 1947, from the date of Operation High Jump, until 1958, nobody heard a word. Not a word. Now, something happened in 1958. Something very strange happened. Did you ever hear of an operation called Operation Argus?
Operation Argus.
Right. It was a scientific operation where the U.S. Navy sent 15 warships, one of them was called the Norton Sound, toward the eastern coast of Africa. I was supposed to reach the 200 miles from the coast, and it was supposed to launch three nuclear missiles in space at different heights, like a height of 100 miles, 200, 300, to check the radiation effect. Now get this. Now remember, they're supposed to launch three missiles. Well, that ship, Norton Sound, instead of going through the Panama Canal for a shortcut, went further down south to Antarctica. In the middle of the week, there are stories from sailors that have seen three nuclear explosions down in Antarctica, right when the ship passed the area. I'm not guessing, I'm almost positive, that that ship, the Norton Sound, blew up those three nuclear warheads. Thinking that maybe if they catch somebody off guard, they can create some damage to the German Nazis or the aliens or whatever. But apparently, they did nothing. Those Nephilim, the Nibiruites, have almost like an instant barrier, an ability to build an instant canopy, just like they were building for the home planet around the cities and the mining gold here. They can build canopies in an instant. Not only that, they can extract the energy from the nuclear warhead explosions to their benefit. Now, as soon as those three explosions occurred, the USS Norton Sound went straight up around Antarctica, back to Africa, where it was supposed to be originally, and performed the three experiments. Now, those days, you have to remember, there was no internet, there was no radio, there was no TV, only a couple of papers or radio stations. So all the papers carried is three nuclear explosions in space. The Russians didn't say a word, the English didn't say a word, nobody did, because they're all in on a gig. So it was one big cover-up.
Well, this is all highly interesting, and what I wanted to get back to now, we're going to go back to 1947. Operation High Jump is over. A bunch of Navy ships sent to the bottom of the sea. A bunch of others cut up into barely floating pieces, limp their way back to the United States. Admiral Byrd goes into debriefing, and in July of 1947, what happens?
In July 3rd, 1947, something crashed at Roswell. Most of us know one crash at Roswell, but it seemed that between one and seven crashes occurred also nearby the town of Corona and the nearby country of New Mexico. Now, the crash. The question is, why did it crash? Well, I'm going to give you the answer right now. The two halves to the answer, why and the cause. The reason why it crashed in Roswell, why, is nuclear fusion. However, the answer to the second half of the question, it's a really important one, is what was the cause of the crash? The cause of the crash was DNA. It sounds wild, I know. DNA. Now, just a few days before the crash of Roswell, most people don't even remember. Something else happened a week earlier. On June 24, 47, the famous Kenneth Arnold sighting. But most people cannot put together, connect the dots. You know why? They never had a chance to. 7 days before Roswell, a private pilot called Kenneth Arnold, businessman, flew his plane right near Mount Rainier in Washington. And he observed three flying objects. Three flying saucers. I'm sorry, not three. Nine flying objects. Nine. Now, I mentioned earlier that between one and seven crashes occurred in Roswell. That's true. Now, he saw nine. Those nine flying objects that he observed near Mount Rainier in Washington, they were flying in formation in broad daylight. It was a sunny day. As if they were saying to the whole world, hey, here we are. What are you going to do about it? Now, these nine flying saucers, they were on a mission. The one that Kenneth Arnold observed, I'm positive, are the same one that crashes Roswell a week later. Those nine flying saucers were on a mission. Now, get this. They were on a secret destination on the way to the moon. Why? To destroy a very ancient, a very special top-secret power source. Now, did anybody really ever try to make the possible connection? No. Well, let me explain what a power source is for. When our astronauts landed on the moon the first time, Apollo 11, they formed some experiments, sound experiments, they found out through sound vibrations that the moon is actually hollow. I believe there's a fellow called Richard C. Hoagland who can verify it by his research. They also investigated, they tried to drill holes in the moon with a drill to put a flat pole in and some other experiments. The drills they used, they were super hard drills. They couldn't even scratch the surface of the moon. They couldn't even nick it. So what I'm saying, those UFOs try to blow up a very secret power source on the moon and also experiment something. I'll explain. When those Nephilim fell to Earth 55,000 years ago and were in prison here, their superiors put a barrier around the Earth, and the power plant for that barrier, the power source, is on the moon. Now, the moon is roughly 250,000 miles away from the Earth, the average distance. So is the barrier. It originates on the moon, and it's all the way around the Earth. Now, that barrier, I call in my book, is a gamma G barrier. G stands for gene. Here's how it works. I said earlier, those Anunnakis are DNA experts. That barrier is built, it's an invisible barrier, is built to search, detect, and destroy any being with a certain DNA type. And of course, they know the exact DNA code of 200 Nephilim. Like in the army, they work for them, you know, same bunch, they know exactly. That barrier will detect and destroy anything that resembles the DNA code of the 200 Nephilim that were banished to this planet and prison here. They'll kill them immediately.
Well, now you said there were 200 Nephilim, and then through crossbreeding and cloning, there are some 2 million that contain this DNA. Over a period of tens of thousands of years, maybe that DNA proliferates through the human genome. Were the astronauts that went to the moon specifically screened for certain DNA so that they could go to the moon and back?
I got news for you. Human beings with that DNA is more than 2 million. It's 2 million Nazis in Antarctica. But unfortunately, most of the human race carries the same DNA. Most of the human race carries the same DNA. Now, what's going on? Do you remember many astronauts that come back from moon missions have very long debriefings?
Sure.
Very long. Some return nauseous, dizzy. I'm afraid that those astronauts, now many of them I do know are, originally nobody knew that, but now we do, were 31st, 32nd degree Masons, the ones that walked on the moon.
They were also Eagle Scouts.
Right. It's coming to public knowledge now. Now, what I believe is happening, I can verify it, of course, I believe those astronauts are getting massive, massive blood transfusions before they go on the missions. Massive. A certain type of blood transfusions that are being discovered slowly, slowly by microbiologists. A certain type. And I remember, the Nephilim, with their DNA, cannot escape the moon's distance. But they may be able to approach it. But I believe that our astronauts have been used as guinea pigs to test that barrier. And that's exactly why originally, in 1947, in Roswell, those UFOs crashed. They tried then. The 9-UFO that Kenneth Arnold spotted, the destination was the moon. They tried to test the barrier.
And that's why they were hurled back to Earth and why they crashed. Now, if the secret is in microbiology, if the secret is in cleaning up that DNA so that Nephilim can try to get through that barrier and escape out into the universe. Wouldn't you think that as advanced as we are in microbiology, that microbiologists worldwide would be employed to work on and find this secret? What's happening to microbiologists worldwide?
They're dying one by one.
Natural
causes? Apparently, soon they come close to discover what they're working on, the project, and open the mouth, they're being eliminated.
So they're not dying of natural causes, they're being taken out.
Correct.
Now, are these small numbers of microbiologists here and there, little accidents and car accidents and heart attacks, or are we talking a large number of microbiologists?
It's already over 400. Drowning, pools, accidents. One by one, they're all microbiologists. One by one.
So they're discovering the secret of what they're working on. So my question is, why us? I mean, yes, we are these biological transducers running around the planet right now, multiplying like rabbits, you know, as much as we can afford to do. But what about the soul? What about the being inside the body? What happens to that?
Uh-huh. Here comes the big one for tonight, okay? Here comes the grand finale. Do you remember when Noah, when God tried to save Noah with the ark? He called Noah a righteous man. You're a righteous man.
Right.
Well, he didn't refer to Noah as a righteous man being religious, being goody-goody. Uh-uh. You refer to him as a righteous man because Noah carried a certain pure human DNA. Human, not alien. And those aliens, those Nephilim, the 200 advantages, they knew they would need one day, they would need a pure human DNA to reverse engineer themselves to escape the barrier. How's that sound?
Well, it begins to make sense, but what happens on December 21st, 2012, if they can't get this biological key to get through the barrier?
Not very good things. They have to escape. Now, what they're getting prepared for now is the zero hour, which is the worst thing for us. Do you remember when the Soviet Union fell, when Reagan yelled, the Soviet, tear down that wall in Berlin.
Right.
That's it. A few months afterwards, the Russians went, hey, Americans, please take our atomic bombs from us. We don't want to keep them anymore. We're afraid that they're going to be stolen by third world countries, whatever. Am I correct?
That's right. They wanted to get rid of all those warheads. Right.
Thank you. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you know where all those warheads wound up?
Well, they're supposed to go a little plant in eastern Tennessee and be turned into fuel, but they never showed up.
Yet. They wound up on secret space shuttle missions on the moon.
Now, I got a question for you. If they didn't end up in Irwin, Tennessee to be turned into nuclear fuel for power stations, and they were taken to the moon and dumped like so much nuclear waste.
Oh, no. They were not dumped. Buddy. No. That's what their plan for the moon for the zero hour.
Uh-huh.
If everything else fails, those aliens, bar none, now listen to this, no matter what, they're going to try to destroy that energy source on the moon. No matter what. If our planet explodes, if it's half damaged, half gone, if everything else fails, they're going to try to destroy the power source on the moon any way they can, including they have to destroy us. We are nobody to them. We are just little people. They come first, as far as they're concerned.
Do you think the L-Cross mission, October 28th of this year, that 3,600-pound bullet they're going to fire at the pole of the moon, do you think that's a test mission for that?
Yes. That's the beginning. at the beginning. The big one will come with no test. The big ones will take all the powers, everything they got, one big bang. And watch out. The biggest bang, as science fiction as it sounds, like in the movies, the biggest bang, got, you know, got to help us all. If they do damage to the moon, you know, if, structurally, whatever, if it's hollow, there's the end of all of us. But then, who cares? Because theoretically, we're going to be dead anyway.
So well, it's just a mortal body, and I'm assuming that other worlds have been destroyed the same way. What happens if the ones who imprisoned them, the ones on Nibiru, what happens if they show up to stop that and keep the power grid intact? And by the way, why don't they just ask us our help? We don't want them here anymore anyway. We're tired of fighting each other.
Yeah, two things may happen. Now, those Anunnaki on planet Nibiru may know what's going on here, they may not. But I believe they do know. If all comes down to the last second, to the 64th hour, they may, I'm saying they may, to the goodness of their heart to save us, they may form a canopy around the Earth. Just like they're doing for their own planet Nibiru. They can do it 1, 2, 3, if they wish to. If they wish to. It's the only thing I feel they can really do to save us.
Wow. What an amazing tale. We are just about out of time. We have about 2 minutes left. Aaron Kaplan's book, Deep Analysis, Frightening Conclusion. One more time, give out your websites and tell our listeners how to get this amazing book.
It's http://deepanalysis.com. Frightening Conclusion, one word, deepanalysisfrightingconclusion.com. Or I'm a publisher, www.libris, it's xlibris.com. Or just call 888-795-4274.
Aaron, amazing story. I got to tell you, it's one of the few books I have not been able to put down. I found myself walking around the house reading it because I didn't want to put it down. Amazing book. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
And you're welcome, and thanks for having me on.
It was our pleasure. You have a wonderful week.
And thank you again.
Good night.
Good night.
All right, there you have it, Earth Explorers. Definitely one of the most amazing stories we have ever covered on this program. And there's much more that we did not cover tonight. We just did not have time. Amazing book. I urge you to go out and read it. Get prepared. The book, Deep Analysis, Frightening Conclusion by Aaron Kaplan. We'll see you next week. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio, saying, Peace, Earth Explorers.